This morning, in this hour of the program, we were talking with writer Brian Boldry. He is a novelist. He's the author of several books, including Love and the Magician, The Genius of Desire, The Autobiography Box. He's also the editor of anthologies Wrestling with the Angel, Best American Gay Fiction 1 through 3, and Traveling San Francisco Bay Guardian. And he also has a new book out that we'll be talking about here this morning. It's a collection of essays exploring the topic of masculinity and manhood. The topic, the title of the book is Monster, Adventures in American Machismo, and it's published by Council Oak Books. He's here visiting the campus. His home is in Chicago. He teaches in the creative writing department at Northwestern University. And we're pleased for him to be here. And again, people want to join in the conversation as we go along here. Certainly questions, comments are welcome. All we ask of people is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so we can keep things moving along. But anybody can be a part of the conversation. 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana listeners. We also have a toll-free line. Go out anywhere. You can hear us. 800-222-9455. 333-WILL. Toll-free. 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
What monster? Why monster?
Well, it's funny because the title did go round and round. It is the short answer is that it's probably the centerpiece essay in the collection was a piece I wrote for an anthology called Chick for a Day. What would you do if you were one? And just kind of talking about gender. But then that kind of led to writing a series of feature stories about macho activities, rodeos, boxing, bachelor parties, World Wrestling Federation, from kind of a sissy's point of view and kind of a sissy who kind of likes that kind of thing in some weird backhanded way and exploring that. And it was all done under another title, which was how the book was submitted, under Paper Dandelion, after George Plimpton's book about being a Detroit Lion for a season. It was a big salute. That's a great book. If anybody ever wants to read a good book about sports, if it's still in print or if you can get your hands on one, Paper Lion's the one. Mm-hmm. But I think that's the other reason we changed the title is we think that book might be so far in the past that people wouldn't have made the connection. So Monster has its kind of a scary sound to it, and seemed the one to go with.
Yeah, well, as you say, it is a collection of pieces that really, and any of them, I think, would stand on their own about these different scenes, in a way, going to a place where they race these midget cars, and going to the rodeo, and going to the wrestling, and also pieces about men, sort of enjoying one another's company in doing guy stuff and sort of why it is that maybe partly is why it is that guys like to do guy stuff,
right.
and you know how it is we have to do to make it okay to be with other guys and not thought of as no one wants to be thought of as a sissy,
right
you know,
right
to be guys doing guy stuff together, and you know it's as if we're sort of a little uncomfortable with liking that. So but then there are certain ways and certain situations and stuff where it's perfectly okay.
Right. Well, and I've been struck always by the fact that some of those strict rules are almost fussy, you know, that those, mm-hmm. you know, you can talk about, you can be an articulate man if you're talking about the parts of a car or, you know, you can or, you know, that you can be specific about a batting average or, you know, the horsepower of your SUV. But, you know, the inarticulate man who is considered the macho man has to have a place where he can express himself or, you know, finding ways around the rules becomes so particular that they become that they're almost sissified. I mean, I hate to use the word again, but it's just wow. You know, men can be fussy about food. I only want hamburgers and stuff like that. But that's in a way that's secretly fussy. You know, kind of thing. But
yeah. Well, what really is going on here? I mean, is it really that that men maybe think men really do enjoy each other's company and want to be with other men? And yet somehow we also have a bunch of rules about, well, what you can and
yes,
can't
I know.
Do. And so we look for some ways in which we can do it in a safe sort of way.
I do. And I guess the most generous part of me wants to say that actually they are just as articulate as women, or, you know, and they just find another way of doing it. There was this line from that talking about philosophers. Wittgenstein once said, "If a lion could speak, he wouldn't speak our language." And I think that about macho men. They kind of they're just not speaking the language you think they're speaking. You know, that you think that they must have this vocabulary and that's how they're going to express themselves. But they express themselves in a lot of other ways. And I'm hoping that I'm getting to the bottom of some of those ways in those essays.
Mm. Is how much of this do you think it is about our, in a sense, attraction to physicality, and that's something that we almost innately do appreciate, and yet, well, you got to be really careful about how you do that. And so, say, you know, something like boxing,
yeah,
where here are two guys in the ring and wearing almost no clothes. You know, sweaty, muscular, really huge, tough guys beating the heck out of each other, which seems on one level to be a bizarre thing to like, you know, for any sort of reason. But it seems sort of almost more bizarre if what partly is going on is that that's a safe way for us to appreciate another man's body. I mean, do you think that's part of what's happening?
I think it is. And I think it's sort of a strange alchemy of several things. That men, in particular, the going to the first part about when is it okay to look at another guy, and it's usually when they're in action. You can't. Mm-hmm. We sort of make women the subject of portraiture, and we make, you know, that a woman. No, and women are fully comfortable, are raised to be comfortable with that. Anyway, they walk across a room at a party and they know that they are being looked at as a woman walking across a room. And that men, I think, see themselves or consider themselves to be invisible. And that is the ideal place for a man. And that and that has all sorts of ramifications. But you are allowed to look at men when they're doing a great football tackle, or, you know, winning the race, or boxing with another man. And so that it's when we're in motion, we can be looked at. And then you get the whole layer of when can you make contact with another man, when two men can do that. And it kind of has to be anything other than tender, doesn't it? So that boxing, you know, hitting somebody is you're making contact, or, you know, tackling, those sorts of moves are also okay times to touch another man, and contact is being made, and there is a craving for contact, isn't there? And then there is the whole thing about gracefulness, and, you know, that kind of, you don't, ballet obviously is a sort of a sissy, considered a sissy sport or whatever, but you could argue that a lot of times a really good football tackle is pretty graceful, you know, in an ugly sort of way.
Yeah. or seeing a guy run down the field.
Absolutely.
Guys doing other, you know, playing basketball, doing gymnastics, all those kind of things are really beautiful and can be very graceful. Obviously, are physically very demanding. It's not something that we can all do,
right?
Unfortunately, you know, even if you'd feel like you'd like to, it's not something that everybody can do. So it's got to be something that you really could appreciate on a really elemental sort of level.
Right. And in just saying, you know, you're saying we can't all do it. That is when we're allowed to admire another man, when we envy them, you know, when I said, I wish I had the ability to, you know, walk on the horse or do the pommel horse or whatever those things that those gymnastic guys do. That's why I don't know the names of those things, because I'm that jealous.
Our guest is Brian Boldry. He's a writer. He teaches creative writing at Northwestern. He's done fiction. This book here we're talking about this morning is nonfiction. It's essays. The title is Monster Adventures in American Machismo, and it's published by Council Oak Books. Should be able to find it in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. He's here visiting the campus, and we're talking about it. Questions, comments, whatever's on your mind, you're welcome. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. But one of the things, I guess just because I mentioned it, maybe it's because on the cover there are a big picture of boxing gloves, is one of those things that I guess I don't really quite understand. And you know, what the appeal would it be for anybody? Because it's it's the most intentionally violent sport. There are contact sports like football, you know, where there's a lot of violence, and maybe indeed some of that is intentional. But it's not really the prime object of the whole thing. Like boxing is, as I said, the prime object is to beat the other guy senseless. Why anybody would want to do it, and then why other people would want to go and watch, this is kind of a mystery to me.
Yeah, I think when I was working on the essay on boxing for the book, I visited a number of boxing gyms, and so many of the guys who were boxing, and women, by the way, there are a lot of women now doing it, have a past of some sketchy nature. Some of them were recovering from drug abuse and addiction, from crime. They were out of jail and things like this. And it was their first way back into the world in some way that was that where they were able to kind of contemplate how to put this. I hope I put it better in the book than I am about right now. But they were very proud of their losses. When boxers talk about boxing, they don't hide the number of times they lose. They're very much upfront about, well, I've only won 2 bouts in my whole career as a boxer. But the fact that they turn loss into victory, it's sort of another way of thinking about it would be that it isn't a waste of time to do a geometry problem wrong, a proof of a geometry problem, because you learn something along the way. And I think that's what I'm putting words into their mouths, but I think that what they were trying to explain, the appeal to them was for boxing, that, yes, I always lose, but I'm learning a lot along the way. I'm learning about changing those terms and how much can I withstand. It becomes a whole endurance thing, an ordeal on that level, that they if they can come through the ordeal alive, then there is a victory kind of thing. But I also think that a lot of times men specifically, because we're in a culture where, you know, inarticulateness is the way to be, you're a man of few words carrying a big stick, that there's so much stuff pent up that they crave some movement of some sort. And we, most of us, because we speak, we can create movement in our lives, self-discovery. And that this is a way. Boxing is a way to create some physical manifestation of the inner, maybe.
Why do you think people watch? Why do you think people want to go to the fights?
Perhaps it is some kind of very basic ballet, that there is a gracefulness. I mean, if I look at, there's a wonderful documentary about the Zaire fight between Muhammad Ali and
was it Joe Frazier?
Was it Frazier? I think it is.
When we were kings.
When we were kings.
Yeah. About the rumble in the jungle. Right?
Yes, right. And, you know, they had Plimpton and they had Mailer kind of. They were both on the site when that was all happening. And their descriptions, I just remember Plimpton saying, and, you know, he was being kind of pushed against the ropes and he was looking out. And it was as if he was hanging out the window of a tenement looking at the floor above him. You know, there was some kind of gracefulness to it, that there was a ritualization of something happening that it is amazing to watch. I have to say it's mesmerizing in the way a car crashes. And that it does have that kind of basic voyeuristic quality to it. What other reasons do we watch? I think that it does have to do with the. I'm thinking it out here on the air.
Yeah, that's okay. We make it up as we go along.
that there is something about pinning your own personal stuff on their fight. That you're withstanding with them in some sort of way. That there's a possibility that one could be doing the same thing, or that this is the limit that mankind, as the sexist term is, could pull in everybody into this, and this is one extreme of us that we all are. That there's a strange identification on that level. Hmm. I have to say that it isn't one of my favorite things to do. But I'm more fascinated with friends who do spar all the time. I mean, I have friends who just go and they do it just. to put on the gloves and get some aggressions out. But the actual fights, I don't watch that much.
Yeah. When you think about the differences between men and women and how they behave, we go to sweeping generalizations that, in some sense, of course, are sweeping generalizations and they go too far. And in another sense, maybe there's some kernel, you know, there. And I guess one of the things that seems always to come out is that women seem much more about connection, connectedness, being with other people, being with other women, doing for others. And men seem much more about being alone, about solitariness, and also about competition, about rising above the pack, all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is?
It is a really interesting, I think, and it's very true in its massive generalization.
Yeah.
But and you think about even in team sports, we love to rally around the one guy who's breaking the record for the number of home runs in a row, or you know, we always pick out somebody from the team to say they're actually doing the thing on their own when there are tons of assists in all sorts of ways, and I think it has a lot to do with this notion of a hero and bravery that goes in, you know, into some sort of gladiatorial times or something, that a man stands alone, you know, on his own two feet kind of thing, that this is a sort of, whereas women, you know, they're sort of, you think about what men fight for instance. We're fighting now in Afghanistan for freedom, big concepts, abstract concepts, freedom and justice and that sort of thing. And then women fight for home and family, you know, much more concrete things. And so that by nature involves concrete people, real, you know, that there is something about making a home. And what I've been thinking so much about in these times of war, where, you know, there's all sorts of people being kind of called brave and some are called cowardly, that those terms are actually morally neutral. They're not, we think of brave people as being is understood to be good. Brave equals good, coward equals bad. Mm-hmm. And it was something I think that the guys from the Politically Correct, that show, got in trouble for saying, well, I don't know if it's really, we could consider flying a plane into a building as an act of cowardice. That seemed pretty brave to me. And that, you know, kind of sorting through those words is, men don't think about the words, they think of, they're pretty basic about those words. Brave means being alone and doing something on their own, but that doesn't mean it's good, kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking maybe it was, you know, some of the introductory section where you write about having gone hunting with your brother.
Yeah.
And it's something that he is a hunter and apparently really likes to do that, but you sort of wonder, well, what really is it all about, and what is the part that you really like? And you seem to suggest that maybe, you know, for him, part of the thing is, and maybe it would be, you know, for other men doing things like that, what they really like is to be out there alone.
They probably do. I mean, I think, and I don't know if that's something in our body's chemistry, maybe even. I know that he's a devoted person to his family. He's a breadwinner and stuff like that, but he is kind of a loner. In his high school career, he was a great baseball player and great team player. But I've noticed in that essay, I kind of talk about the fact that he had some hunting buddies, but over the years, they've kind of dropped off for various reasons. One of them is that he's sort of likes to do, he's picky. There's another one of those not very macho things, but he doesn't shoot at anything that moves. He wants the one big deer a year, which he, I have to say, is somebody who doesn't hunt. I admire him for just wanting the one deer. He dresses it. He uses everything. But all of his friends just want to go out and shoot everything. And so he basically has become an unpopular hunter. He's, you know, with his buddies. I don't think he would like me to say that about him, but he's contented to track alone. He does a lot of tracking and that sort of stuff, which also lends itself to being alone and doing his own thing. And he has a lot more patience than these guys, and he doesn't go out there to drink. In fact, he reads. I watched him reading on a log while he was waiting for something to show up. And that I think that there are times that men, after all of their obligations to family and job and all those sorts of things, crave some place to be alone. And a lot of the stuff that used to be in place for getting away from the world have kind of collapsed, whether that's things like bowling leagues or Masonic lodges. Those things are apparently, according to statistics, have just completely evaporated over the last last generation. So suddenly they're finding themselves finding their own fun. And I think men alone has become even more the case than it was even 30, you know, they at least men were alone together in the Masonic lodge drinking beers, but that was where they did that. And now they're just on their own on it.
About halfway through here, this part of Focus 580 with Brian Boldry. He lives in Chicago. He teaches in the creative writing department at Northwestern University. He's the author of several books. And this collection of writing, this is nonfiction about masculinity and manhood. It's titled Monster, Adventures in American Machismo, published by Council Oak Books. In the bookstore, if you'd like to look at it, he's here visiting the campus. Questions, comments, whatever's on your mind, you can give us a call, be a part of the conversation. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I guess one of the things that, you know, it makes me think about in looking at some of these essays is about guy things. And what it is about guy things that guys like, and whether it is that we've been taught to like those things, we've been told we're supposed to like those things, or that somehow we just kind of, that there is something hardwired that makes one like those kinds of things.
Yes, you know, and I have to say about three of the topics, and I think I even say it explicitly when I talk about those little little sprint cars I went to see, they just put me to sleep personally. But my best friend from high school, who lives up in Minnesota, he just can't get enough of them. And I don't consider him to be a super macho guy. But I think that it is hardwired in him. And I think that there must be something that I think men are trained to kind of objectify. We look at things as objects, and cars are often have a sensuality to them, and I would even dare say an erotic quality to them. I don't think it's a mistake or some. I think it really evolved that when they always have the chick in her bikini kind of standing next to the sports car. There's some connection going on there.
You don't have to be Freud to figure that one out.
Yes, exactly. It might not all of them. All of the checklist is not all checked off on the guy card. You know, it might not be always fast cars, rodeos, you know, football and all those sorts. But there's something in all men that there's one of those might be checked off, and and it's some kind of outlet for that being an outer person rather than an inner person. And assigning gender to that seems so dangerous, but it just keeps coming up. You know, saying. Women have sort of there's an internalization, there's this inner life that seems much more rich, and that men like to just be out in the outer life, being out and doing something physical, that might just have to do with testosterone or something like that. But it just keeps coming up, and I can't deny gender. I can't vive la différence, though. You know, I do like that there are differences.
You were talking about for example, that you went to this thing where the guys are saying they're racing these cars that are essentially like almost like souped up go-karts, these tiny little things. And they're so small, they have to put airfoils like wings on the top to hold them down.
Yeah.
So that when they're going, it puts the downward pressure on the car so it doesn't, I guess, flip over or you know, whatever. And that didn't jazz you much. And I know that you did the one piece about having gone hunting with your brother and that you felt, well, that wasn't exactly the kind of thing that you wanted to do. But of all of the things that maybe you did, you know, going to the rodeo and the Masonic Lodge and all that kind of stuff, did you find things that you actually surprisingly enough to you, you thought, hey, I kind of like this and I wouldn't have thought about it.
Absolutely. I have to say the rodeo is I just really there's some things I kind of mildly disapprove of. In fact, I was just in San Francisco going to the Grand Nationals again on Sunday and watched for the first time somebody actually being gravely hurt. I got word that he lived through it, but he was basically riding a bareback bull. Got thrown immediately off, and the bull hit, you know, stomped his head, and it was very disturbing to watch. I've never, it has made me kind of rethink it. But on the other hand, I'm attracted to, in being kind of primarily an urban guy, being in the city, a life where you are in some way with nature. And I don't know if it's saying, you know, that the way they treat these animals is kind of sketchy at times. But on the other hand, I think that they're, sometimes I'm much more concerned about people anthropomorphizing animals. I kind of see things like, you know, that Donald Duck has kind of made people vegetarians or something like that. And I just think, well, you know, this is, we may not have the perfect healthy relationship with nature, but that is not the answer, is by making them, imposing our feelings on them, saying that doggies have the same feelings that we have. I think that they are a different thing, and there's other ways of respecting animals that by, you know, maybe by riding them, you know, we don't know. I mean, it's hard to know the other, but let alone other animals in the kingdom. Mm-hmm. But I do. I see them. The cowboys and the cowgirls, for that matter. There's something, they seem to understand those animals more than I do. So I don't feel like I can make that judgment. They seem to have. I see them talking to the horses. I see these. You know, there's some kind of relationship there that I envy.
Yeah. Well, they've got to be bonded to the, with the kind of stuff that they do, you have to be bonded to the animals. When you see them riding and you see the stuff that they do, they seem to be one, you know, and as if the rider doesn't have to, you know, almost tell the horse what to do. It's almost like the rider can think what to do and the horse gets it.
It's astonishing. Yeah. And I'll just see kids doing it. I mean, there would be sort of these little drill teams with 10-year-olds, and the horses were operating them like they were an extra set of legs or something. Just kind of amazing.
And that's when you sit on a horse, that, you know, that is a monumental hunk of muscle.
Yeah.
And, you know, they do have minds of their own, and they do not always want to do what you want them to do. So that's not necessarily an easy thing.
And I do, and if there's something I objectify, I sit and look at a horse. I can look at a horse for hours. I'm in awe of those beasts. They are just astonishing to me.
And there's, you were talking earlier about you know, men not always, most men not thinking that much about their appearance, not being aware of the way that they move, in the way that women are, and the way that women sort of in at some level of their consciousness when they walk across the room, they're thinking about it, and guys, and you know, mostly not paying that much attention. But it's interesting. I guess I think about it in the stuff that you write about cowboys, that they somehow they are more overtly aware. And that that you know, it's not surprising that a lot of women, and maybe some guys, you know, would find them very sexy.
Yeah.
You know, if for another reason that they, you know, wear extremely tight pants and they wear these enormous belt buckles, and you know, that they're very in a sort of relaxed way. It seems to that they really communicate their awareness of their physicality.
They're even vain. I mean, and that word's also one of those charged words. But it seems to me another thing that's happening in our culture slowly. But men, I have my theories. I think MTV has a lot to do with this. But men are becoming vain. I'm kind of teaching undergrads right now at Northwestern, and they dress to be looked at in the cowboy sort of way. And you know, the cowboy. I'm sure that on a day to day basis, the cowboys don't have those huge belt buckles. Well, maybe they do. I haven't seen them out there, but I know that at the rodeo, they're dressed to be looked at, and they just got back from the barbers. They have that nape of their neck is, you know, you could set a bet, you know, kind of you could do anything with it's this precision there that I haven't seen in ages. Yeah. That is dress up, go to meet and sort of clothing they're wearing, but that they know that this is the time for them. This is their time in the spotlight, sort of thing. After a sort of a lonesome time out there on the prairie or wherever they're working, that this is where they're being appreciated.
Yeah, I'm interested in your just the last comment about men becoming more vain, and that it being a little bit more okay for men to think more about, say, the clothes that they wear. Or, you know, I guess one of the things that we know is that now men in increasing numbers are going for cosmetic surgery.
Yeah,
they're getting altered. You know, they're getting, if they think they have a little bit too much around the waist, you know, there are guys who are going and they're getting liposuction, or if they think that they're starting to look too old, or you know whatever it is, they're going and getting fixed. And there would have been a time when, I mean, I think now it's probably still not, you know, you wouldn't really want to be seen coming out of the plastic surgeon's office. You'd like to, you know, go in and out the back door. So it's not the kind of thing maybe you would want to brag about, but it's something that more men apparently are doing and willing to do. And I wonder what that's about.
Well, it is, I mean, I guess I want to put the nicest possible spin on it. And my concern for the longest time, this whole notion of being invisible, that guys, it's sort of an arrested growth where it's almost as if they're putting their hands in front of their eyes and saying, you can't see me. It's like a little boy doing that. And that it might be the source of even ethical problems in our culture, that, you know, the politician will put his hands into the tills, or that they're not being seen. They never think that they're being watched, and so that they create all sorts of moral encroachments, that they do bad things because nobody's watching them. And that if men are starting to be more aware of themselves being watched, they might start taking responsibility for their actions, for one thing. And that probably a lot of that stuff, that the vanity is taking care of their bodies, it might be nice to see people being a little bit more healthier. I don't know if like implants and nips and tucks are really under that umbrella, but I think that it has. I mean, it may have some good copy. I'm having trouble talking today, putting for the right words, but there might be some good things coming out of that.
Yeah. I guess I think about, it was not very long ago, I interviewed someone who wrote a book about the male body, and maybe I better give a language advisory here. I'm going to discuss something that some people might find disturbing. So if you think you might, and of course you don't know what it is, you know, go away. Anyway, one of the things that was really the most striking, and the author, who was a woman, deals in this book with things like, men and being obsessive about exercise, for example, spending lots and lots of time in the gym so they could get very muscled, or having plastic surgery. And one of the things that she talks about in this book is cosmetic surgery on the penis.
Huh.
And to make it look bigger, not to be more attractive to women, however, because it doesn't make you bigger, you know, when you want to be, but so that when you're in the locker room and you're around other guys, they will look at you and say, whoa, look at that. Purely cosmetic, not functional at all, and purely to impress other men. And that, you know, it may not be an enormous number of men, but there seems to be a growing interest in having this kind of procedure. And I thought, wow.
Yeah, that's pretty twisted. Isn't that an aspect of vanity? I mean, there it is again. But that's been sort of manifested itself to me in things like the bigger trucks. You know, my truck is bigger. All those sorts of things seem to be other ways of expressing that, in that need to kind of puff up in front of other men. They're like these puffer fish. They really are. And that's the part of vanity that maybe that does bother me a little bit. That's sort of getting away from your own self. I mean, that seems even to a certain extent anti-macho, if you want to be pure about the term. And it's just sort of saying you're not showing your true self. You're actually hiding behind blue tinted contact lenses, or some artificially enhanced penis. You know, that's not you. You're not really. You're kind of protecting. You're hiding your true self, sort of thing. And that seems almost anti-vain, ultimately, then, or something in a weird way.
We have a couple of callers. We'll take them in the order they came in. We'll start with Urbana, line one, right here. Hello.
Hello, yes. Brian. You know who this is. Hi, this is Jean.
Hi.
I wanted to make sure that your listeners knew that Brian will be giving a reading from Monster today at 4 p.m. at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. I'll hang up.
Oh, thanks, okay. Jean. No, that's great. I'm sorry. I guess I hadn't. Oh, maybe I did. Maybe somebody did tell me that. I didn't get that word, because I'm always really pleased to give people the opportunity to hear from authors. So that's the Illini Union Bookstore at the Author's Corner. And then frequently they do have writers there. 4 o'clock this afternoon. So, excellent. Let's go to Bloomington, line number four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I've really been enjoying this.
Huh?
And I'm just wondering, what sort of symbolism would you think about me who has been, I'm an old man, and I've been crazy about pipe organs all of my life. What sort of symbolism would you equate to that?
Well, that is, but there is sort of a, it's not even a symbol, is it? It's sort of the thing in itself, but it's it's two ways, isn't it? Because there's more than one pipe, you know. So you're talking about a team sport going on there. It sounds to me like a pipe organ is a symbol of a bunch of sounds working together rather than one single pipe working alone. Or, you know, if we're going to talk, those are phallic symbols. Yes, we can all say that right here.
I was wondering about that, whether you would think that.
Yeah, well, it seems more of it is kind of having it both ways, where you have multiplicity and solo, you know, one person playing all the pipes kind of thing. But I think there's a real attraction there. I think that's nice.
Okay.
All right. Well, also, It is alleged that Freud also once said, sometimes a cigar is only a cigar.
That's right. When it was convenient for him.
That's right. Other questions are welcome. We have about 10 minutes left with Brian Boldry. And if you're interested in, by the way, reading the essays here we've been talking about, the book that collects them is titled Monster, Adventures in American Machismo, published by Council Oak Books. And he's the author of some others as well. You can look for them in the bookstore. And at 4 o'clock this afternoon, if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, he'll be doing a reading at the Illini Union Bookstore at their Reader's Corner. So you can stop by there and meet him and hear from him. So did you, I mean, I don't know if this is an odd question, but do you think that as a result of sort of doing this and writing the pieces and doing the things that you did, that you learned something about masculinity that you didn't know before?
I've sort of come to terms with a lot of that. I, you know, some of the things I've had judgments about men was pretty hard welded into myself as well. I mean, I'm kind of a person who has trouble being looked at often. I think that I like the idea of being invisible. I think that might have a lot to do with being capital A artist or something, wanting to be the one who's watching everything and trying to encode it himself and not being part of the scene just so that I can stand on the sidelines. But I sat there and kind of said, well, I think it has ethical issues that I can get away with more or something like that. And I've learned, and in fact, I have to say that even the jacket photo is a relapse of mine. If you look at the jacket photo, I'm dressed in camouflage, and it's a long shot of me. You can barely see my face. And my ideas was that I still want to maintain a certain amount of privacy as a person, you know, that there had a lot to do with when I was writing about machismo, this kind of man standing alone, being looked at sort of thing that, there's, even in the culture at large, beyond gender, there's this weird push and pull in the United States in particular, of wanting both to be very private and very famous, you know, and getting it both ways. And you read, and I read celebrities complaining about how they can't get anywhere because, it's, you know, I have no pity sort of thing. You want it both ways. And I think we all do. We want to have a house that, you know, has a garage door opener, the only entrance to it and that sort of thing. And we end up doing these things where we have a kind of new lonesomeness, which is kind of almost symbolized by the cowboy or the, you know, this my brother sitting alone in the woods that looks almost romantic in a way. And trying to get beyond all this, sort of think harder about these terms about fame and romance and macho and bravery and cowardice I've been much more careful about my terms and gender and issues of what we mean by gender.
I'm glad you mentioned the picture because it's this is a hunting scene. Obviously, this must be deer hunting, I guess.
Yes.
Wearing a camouflage jumpsuit, holding a it's a camouflaged gun, wearing an orange hat, of course. And with the stuff that came with the book, there is a copy of this picture, and it's a little bit bigger. And I must say, you don't look real comfortable. you have this look in your face like, this is not me.
It is definitely a Halloween costume. I mean, I think I was, as I wore the stuff, I wore it like a Halloween. I wore it like a dress. I have to say it was a kind of drag, which I think, is another one of those things I kind of talk about, you know, drag queens and transvestites people putting the stuff on, and in a certain way, I'm sure that, you know, big tough men are going to be hating to hear this, but I think sometimes they put on uniforms and they put on hunting camouflage in the same spirit that there's something that I'm going to be somebody else and I'm going to find another way of being, you know, outside of myself, getting outside the self once again, escaping from the self. Mm-hmm. And that it might be a manifestation of one aspect of the self, but often it's drag. It's yeah. all drag. And the leather uniforms that some gays go wear in gay bars or cowboy outfits, they're a kind of drag.
Well, even I'm not sure that you can't extend that to you know, when you put on a big double-breasted pinstripe suit, that's a uniform. It's a conscious, mm-hmm. particularly double-breasted. I think it's a conscious gesture of trying to robe yourself in a symbol that says, I am a big, powerful captain of industry. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when you come home and you put on your jeans that have holes in the knees and an old sweatshirt that you used to paint with, you know, that's another...
It's another statement.
It's another statement.
Yeah.
And I think that that's real, you know, I don't think that that's really all that hard to understand if you can think about it that way.
Right, right.
We have, let's see, I have another caller. This is Urbana. It's line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, what is it about homosexual men that seems to drive some straight men so nuts? I mean, they, you know, you always hear this, you know, once you say, you know, this guy hit on me, and then you get into this really kind of angry tirade stuff from many straight men. That doesn't make sense to me personally, because you'd think, you know, well, if, you know, they're gay, they can do their thing, and it's, you know, not going to affect my ability to date or anything like that. So I was wondering if you had any insights on that.
Well, probably putting myself into the shoes of somebody who would do that, get very angry and have a tirade, that they probably are feeling that there's something in them that drew this hitting upon. I mean, there's I must look like a homosexual. I must, you know, and they don't want to sending out that vibe. I mean, ultimately we can say that that's probably a little bit somebody who doesn't have a very good sense of their self and who they are. But on the other hand, I mean, I think that if somebody came up to me, I mean, children must feel the same way if there's sexual abuse going on or something like that, that there is an aggression going on and say, I must have invited that. Women must feel that when men, you know, there's date rape or stuff like that, I'm sure that they can reason it out and say, well, no, that's not true. But emotionally, there must be a part of you saying, I must have asked for this in some way. And that might be, and the way men deal with things is by puffing up again and becoming violent. I must have, you know, if some guy is hitting on me, I must have invited this in some way, and it creates a kind of terror that manifests itself as anger, as most, that's turned pretty much every emotion into anger. That's the one allowed emotion, probably.
Right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Uh-huh. A little earlier, you were talking about how in the course of having these experiences and doing this writing, you spent a lot of time thinking about gender.
Mm-hmm.
And we seem to, you know, when it comes to thinking about gender, we seem to swing between poles. There's some people who argue that this idea of masculinity and femininity is something, it's immutable, it's biological, it's fundamental. And then people who would make the argument that gender, that is the idea of what it is to be a man, what it is to be a woman, how you behave, how you think, how you act, is completely socially constructed. You know, it's something, it's not something that we're born with, it's something that we learn and we're taught. So there are extreme poles. So which is it?
Well,
is it all that? Is it both?
I guess I would say it's a little bit of both. I'm seeing this in this new generation coming up, if, you know, if the MTV generation or something, I'm often very envious of them because they are playing with gender and they're able to experiment with all sorts of things on the spectrum with, you know, and finding a place in it. But I still think that they depend upon the differences of gender to define themselves. And so that I think that there are, you know, we're all sort of some big chemistry experiment. Each one of us has a little bit of testosterone, a little bit of estrogen, and, you know, and the ways of thinking, you know, it's all that there is a spectrum. But ultimately, there might be something at both ends that kind of pinned down this spectrum. I mean, there's got to be some way to define it, and that's still there in a way. Does that make sense in a way?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, I really do. I say vive la différence, but I think it's wonderful to see people playing with gender and playing, you know, with.
What has happened, do you think, that now makes that, or at least for people who are younger, that makes that okay?
I think they have it's safer to do that now. I think that people understand it more. And especially with people in college, they're experimenting, they're trying to find who they are in even bigger senses of the word. What am I going to do when I grow up and stuff like that? And that they're able to have some kind of safe space to discover that. Older people, I think it's tougher because you've had such a huge history of being this one thing. A quick anecdote. My partner works for an engineering firm, and the head welder of 30 years, Bernard, decided one day that he was much more comfortable being a woman and had a sex change, and still works on the floor, still chief welder, but Bernardine now is the chief welder.
And how do the other guys feel about this?
Well, they've only known Bernardine as Bernard, and still they still treat him as a guy, which is the most frustrating. They're actually very accepting on one level, but they still talk to her in a way that, you know, that in these traditional roles of men and women. And she's been getting nips and tucks herself to make herself look more feminine, but she still has the bones, the body of a man. She's got the structure of a man. So it's really hard for them to kind of deal with that change. It's funny because it's San Francisco and where the stuff happens all the time. And yet we still do identify the way we talk to each other and deal with each other on terms of boys and girls. You know.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that because we come to the end of time. I want to thank you very much for talking
Thank you
us.
For having me. I appreciate it.
Brian Boldry is our guest, and if you're interested in reading some of his work, of course, you can go head down to the bookstore, but particularly you might look for this book we've been talking about here, Monster, Adventures in American Machismo, published by Council Oak. He will be giving a reading at the Illini Union Bookstore today at 4 o'clock in the Author's Corner. So if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can stop by there.